You are listening to the Tricorder Transmissions, episode 67. And
now,
here are
Craig
and
Jeff.
How insensitive I must have seemed when she told me that she loved me. How unmoved and cold I must have seemed when she told me so sincerely.
Hello again, and welcome to the Tricorder Transmissions, episode 67. Today we were going to be talking about the empath, and as always, we are your hosts, Jeff Hewlett.
And Craig Cohen, and it feels like we've been doing a lot of interviews, which is really, really awesome.
The last two episodes we put out, we did a last Sunday and we did a Wednesday supplemental, and there's three interviews between the two episodes.
And if you haven't listened to those, please go back and listen, because all the interviews were awesome, dating, you know, starting with the one we did with Paul about the 1701 rebuild project, right up to the five-year mission guys, and then Scott for the Primate Directive Planet of the Apes crossover. Just a lot of really, really great interviews that were a lot of fun to sit down for.
If you go way back to Paul Olson that you mentioned first, and he's got a lot of great stories about working on the Enterprise model for the motion picture. And, you know, what we were able to get out of him was spectacular. And there's a great update on the upcoming Spock's Brain release from Five Year Mission on last Sunday's episode. So that was really cool. And we also teased a new miniseries that we're going to be doing with Five Year Mission. It's going to be a collaborative effort between Tricorder Transmissions and the Five-Year Mission Guys. Starting up this coming Wednesday, we're going to be doing a deep analysis of each track from each of their albums, starting with year one, track one, The Cage. So look for that this coming Wednesday. So all five of the Five-Year Mission Guys are there, and we'll be talking to principal songwriter Mike Rittenhouse about that track. And there's some great details for Five-Year Mission fans out there. This is pretty exciting.
Yeah, it really was. It was a real privilege to be able to sit down and talk music with those guys because, you know, as a lot of people probably feel, music is so personal and subjective, and, you know, people can find different meanings in you know, different songs. So I think it was a lot. It was really interesting to sit down with those guys and get their idea of what they were attempting to do versus how it turned out. And it was a really, really great experience to sit down, and I'm really looking forward to going through their entire catalog. And it's so awesome that they agreed to do this because, you know, as artists, some people don't feel like they need to discuss or explain the decisions they made while making music. So it's very cool when you can get that insight.
That's a good point. I know you're a musician yourself, so you have some insight into that type of discussion and not wanting to have to talk about every decision that you made. But one thing that I think is great about these sets of interviews that we've been doing with them and are getting ready to start releasing is that there may be some kind of a stigma when you think about a band that does songs about, you know, a TV show or you know, things of that nature. So I think this is really great because it sheds some light on the fact that they're accomplished musicians. You know, they're all good songwriters, and they're working on some great stuff.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. And I think that's probably, you know, the misconception a lot of people have with novelty music in general.
Yeah.
But yeah, and it was interesting to see how their approach has changed along the way as well, in terms of being very sort of, I don't know if obscure is the right word, but not as forward with the idea that they were doing songs about Star Trek.
Yeah, for sure. I agree. So, Star Trek news this week, a little bit on the slim side, but a couple of interesting little tidbits. to talk about. So it appears that Simon Pegg is going to be involved in the writing of the third Star Trek film.
Wow. You know what? I just got back from vacation last night, and I was pretty much unplugged for the most part. So that this is complete news to me, and it's pretty exciting news.
You think so? Yeah, I'm happy about it and kind of reserving myself a little bit, too, because there's so much turmoil going on with this movie, and it almost seems like, you know, we thought there was a script, but maybe there isn't a script, and now they got to get this thing off the ground because it's got to be out for the 50th anniversary, and it seems like there's a lot of hemming and hawing going on.
Yeah, but the thing I really like about Simon Pegg and the work he's done with Edgar Wright, you know, with Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz and The World's End, is the level of emotion that they're able to bring to their films that are, you know, they're genre films, you know, and they're comedies. But, you know, especially all the films sort of deal with friendships at different levels. And I think The World's End really hit some emotional notes. So if Simon Pegg can bring that side of his writing to Star Trek, I think you could get some really special stuff.
Well, let's keep our fingers crossed. You know, I'm hopeful that for the 50th anniversary, we'll have a really great Trek film. And the filming date that has been announced for the beginning of filming is April 15th. So, you know, the release date is scheduled for July 8th, 2016. So that's kind of a breakneck pace.
Yeah, and those people have to start working on tax day.
Yeah, it looks like it. I guess they all have accountants, though. All right, so that not much else on news going on out there. There was a really funny, it's not original series related. I don't know if you've seen this because you were on vacation, but anybody who is a fan of Patrick Stewart, he did a recent guest spot on Jimmy Kimmel where he acted out skits portraying the most annoying passengers on an airplane. And it's really, really funny. If you haven't seen it, seek it out. I'm going to put a link to it in the show notes. So there was, I guess, some sort of an article or a survey that was done, and where they come up with a list of the most annoying passengers to be seated around on an airplane. And instead of just running down the list, they had Patrick Stewart act out each of these characters.
Oh, that's funny.
Oh, it is really, really funny. So keep an eye out for that one. I'll put a link in the show notes if anybody who hasn't seen it. So it's wonderful.
Very cool.
All right. I guess that's about it for the news. I guess we can move on to our commentary section if you're ready.
Oh, yeah.
All right. So The Empath was aired on December 6th of 1968, and a remaster was first aired on July 26th of 2008.
And we have the NBC press release that was issued on November 12th, 1968, and it reads, "Aliens decree death for Captain Kirk, Mr. Spock, and Dr. McCoy in a bizarre experiment in which humans are used as guinea pigs in The Empath on NBC Television Network's Star Trek, Friday, December 6th.
We are going to get started with our scene-specific commentary in 3, 2, 1.
So I got to say, we have an excellent sight coming up, which is always cool to say, which is the Trinity beaming down.
Yeah. They've been doing a lot with just the three of them lately. It seems like the third season is very focused on Kirk, Spock, and McCoy. And there's that interesting little dome again. I swear we've seen that dome before.
Yeah, it's probably something that's been repurposed.
Yeah, it's a very small door, though.
Yeah, yes. They all have to bend down to get in.
Yeah, a little spiral staircase.
Yeah,
and actually, no railings or anything.
Yeah, that kind of looks like the staircase that the monkeys used.
Oh, yeah, you're right. It kind of does. But theirs had a safety railing.
Yeah,
this one, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised. Well, Kirk takes a spill off of it a little bit, so prove my point there. But so we've got a little setup there. Is the research station, and it's set up to watch this star going nova. So they're trying to collect some data on that. And of course, as with every Starfleet research outpost, the people there have disappeared. You know, so the moral of the story, if you watch all three seasons of the original series, is never get assigned to an outpost because you ain't coming back.
But yeah, it seems like the, you know, the bulk of their missions was, you know, investigating, you know, what happened to other crews?
Yeah, it's like, what the heck happened to all these people? So this was actually a very small crew. There were two people at this outpost, which is, I can't imagine being stuck in that little room with one other person.
Oh, yeah. Can you imagine how on edge they probably got with each other?
Man. Yeah, because you're going to see a little bit of a record tape here of these two guys. And there they are. There's, and could you imagine being stuck in that pink outfit, too? Good Lord. Yeah, the one guy's quoting Bible verses, and it's got to be a little claustrophobic in there. But so there's a lot of solar flares apparently going on here that's going to cause the Enterprise to have to break orbit.
Yeah.
You know, once again, they're taking the Enterprise out of the picture. And you know, we're seeing these guys disappearing. So we see something is amiss. They're being teleported somewhere else. So apparently this record tape was recorded 3 months ago, according to Spock. So they've been out of touch. I guess you have to be out of touch for quite a while before they'll send the ship to come look for you.
Yeah.
3 months is a long time.
Yeah. And they're probably not checking in every day. Maybe they're doing weekly status updates or.
Yeah. You would think. I wonder how long the transmissions take to get to
start. Oh, that's another good point.
Yeah. So McCoy, Spock, and Kirk are now in the process of disappearing. But interestingly enough, the original script for this sequence was completely different. In fact, Kirk, Spock, and McCoy in the original script actually were teleported out of the turbo lift on the Enterprise. They didn't actually go down to the planet and get transported from there.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
So that was changed. And that was actually a suggestion by Bob Justman.
All right.
Suggested that change, and they had written that in.
Yeah, this was an interesting script in the sense it was one of a handful that was submitted by a writer that had no previous TV experience, writer Joyce Muscat, who coincidentally has no TV credit after this.
No. And there are some very, very good interview snips with her in the These Are the Voyages Volume 3 by
cool.
Mark Cushman. I read through that section. And there's some great insights from her on the writing of the script and a lot of the revisions that had been made. As with a lot of Trek episodes, the original script is quite a bit different than what actually got made and produced and put on the air. So the original story that she had come up with about the empath, about Jim.
I love how the title comes up on black.
Yeah, that is really cool. Yeah. There's a lot of black in this episode.
It's very cinematic.
Yes, but so the original story that she had written about Jim and her evolution stayed intact for the most part, while a lot of other things changed around it.
Sure.
So interesting bit. So highly recommended. Check that out in the book. There's a lot of great insight. And it may. This of course is one of those episodes that a lot of Trek fans kind of, you know, they get down on it a bit. It's maybe not one of the best episodes, but it happens to be DeForest Kelly's favorites, or one of his favorites. And reading about it in Cushman's book, it's another one of those situations where it kind of opened my eyes to some of the things that were that I overlooked.
Yeah.
While I had watched this previously. So interesting too that this black set, all of these black set pieces and the nothingness, the surrealism of this episode was actually the writer's idea.
Okay.
It wasn't because of the budgetary restrictions, but I mean, that was one of the things that they considered when they took the script, that it would help to save some money on set building. But it was originally the writer's idea. It was Joyce Muscat's idea to have them actually be more like a Star Trek play.
Okay.
A stage play.
Yeah,
being filmed. So that's kind of what this represents. It now that I'm thinking about it, it does look kind of like a stage play, doesn't it? Especially the way the lighting is done,
yeah,
and how things are dark and then lights hit them to reveal them. So very interesting way to do this. And this is a very unique episode. I can't think of any other ones that are like it. Maybe Spectre of the Gun is similar with the surrealism, but you know, this is a very singular episode.
Yeah.
So very cool stuff. Very cool stuff. But we are now seeing them, of course, underground. They've been transported underneath the alien planet. And I'm not sure. So I think Spock says somewhere how far they were transported, but I didn't catch that part.
Yeah, it wasn't too incredibly deep.
No, it's deep enough for them to feel effects from it, as we'll see shortly.
Oh, right, yeah.
Where Kirk gets the bends. So,
yeah.
And that usually only happens if you're at great depths and ascend quickly in the pressure change. But Shatner has a little cut on his head, by the way, that he incurred from falling down off the staircase.
Yeah, and this is the first indication in the episode for me where I like seeing the tricorder actually being used and doing its thing.
That's a good point.
Yeah. This is, you know, the first instance in the episode where you're really keyed in into that. It seems like Shatner was just really going to tune into the emotional aspects of this performance. I don't know if it was written or if it was the decision that was made between him and the director, but it seems like he's always sort of compassionate and emotional, but it seems like that aspect of his character is really sort of ramped up in this episode.
Yeah, I think that kind of plays into the fact that this was intended to be more of a stage play type of scenario. And I think Shatner always feels more at home because he is a veteran of the stage. And,
yes.
Of course, in the third season where, you know, of course, we've said budgets were restricted a lot and they had to focus more on characters and interplay and dialogue. And I think all three of them in this episode, definitely McCoy and Kirk, go very, very emotional. And there's a bit of an interesting interview clip that from Nimoy about the Spock character in the third season that I'm gonna read off a little bit later in the show.
Oh, cool.
That talks about how he changed up Spock's character a bit. But now we get the entry of the Vions or the Vions.
Another judgmental race.
Yes, another superior race who want to test and find the worthy ones. And
but you know what? How superior is a race if they're judging other races on their morality?
That's a good question. I think it seems like when these races develop either some sort of a power that allows them to manipulate, I guess, what they consider lesser races, or technology that allows them to lord over others, I guess they begin to develop that type of personality where they their morals kind of slip away, you know, kind of like we saw in Plato's Stepchildren recently.
Right. Yeah.
Where, you know, when they didn't have those powers, they were a bit more empathetic and not as quick to abuse. But then they found themselves pretty much Superman.
Yes.
Like, well, we don't need you people anymore. We're superior because you can't physically harm us. There's no way for you to fight back. So I'm not in the beginning of this episode and most of the way through, we think that of the Vions. But I guess later on, they kind of flip the script morally. But interesting insight about this episode that I had read in the Voyages book, by the way. And I had kind of had an inkling of this myself is, there was an opinion that this episode seemed like a redux of The Cage.
Yes.
And even the aliens sort of look like.
They definitely look like they could be cousins of the Talosians.
Absolutely they do. But they're not, of course, as sophisticated mentally, I guess. They're more reliant on technology.
Yeah.
And those devices they have in their hands. Other than that, I mean, they don't seem to have any sort of powers that they can use to manipulate anybody. It's just from the use of these force fields that they can project on you and throw you around and things of that nature. But did you notice that in this previous scene that they made quite a few references to other planets and things that we haven't seen? There was a reference to the sand bats of Minar 4 that appear as rock crystals. And Kirk talked about a race of mute people on Gamma Virtus 4. So I thought that was a little bit strange that they make these references to these other alien races and planets that we haven't seen yet.
Right.
So we're seeing the empath's ability, Jem's ability to take the injuries of others and transfer them to herself.
Yeah, with, you know, some pretty sophisticated effects for the late 60s.
Yeah, actually, that is true. I guess I was trying to think about how they had achieved that, and I guess that's two superimposed video or film feeds over each other that kind of make it look, because they kind of that weird slow mo effects, and when she blinks or her when she's healing and she blinks and her mouth opens a little bit.
Yeah, yeah, but I'm sure it requires a lot of patience on the actor's part to stay still while they match shots and then overlay them. And it's neat. I think they went through a little bit more trouble than they needed to.
Probably.
But maybe that's my eyes in 2015 saying, you know, selling that effect in 68 was probably a lot more impressive, where I was thinking of ways the filmmakers could have gotten around it with quick cutting and stuff like that. But I guess the impressiveness of seeing a wound transition like that was probably very, very cool to see.
I agree, especially because you see the some of the traditional jump teleporting going on, where, you know, it's just that quick cut and people disappear very abruptly without fading out or anything. We saw that done with the teleports earlier with that weird, like almost a liquid projection, but they instantly disappear. They don't fade away.
Right.
They freeze, but they chose to use that effect for her and the healing and the transference of the injury and the healing of that injury later. But one thing I have to give to Jem is that she's a very unique alien in the original series universe, as most aliens speak English.
Yes.
She doesn't.
Yeah.
Well, she seems to understand it, though.
Mm-hmm.
But I always thought it was kind of funny that all the aliens always spoke English, but I was kind of glad that she didn't.
Yeah, and she is from a race of mutes.
Yes.
Which, it made me wonder why they even have mouths. I guess to eat?
Hmm. Perhaps. Or maybe to breathe when their nose are stuffy. I don't know.
That's actress, by the way, Catherine Hayes, born in 1933, and she was on a lot of shows in the 60s, Dr. Kildare, The Lieutenant, which was a Gene Roddenberry show, Bonanza, The Road West. She did multiple episodes of that. As the World Turns, she was on 244 episodes of that, starting in 1978 and ending in 2010.
Wow. Huh. She's got quite a film history.
Yeah. So here we see kind of imposing suggestion of where the three of them can end up.
Yep. And they have their little tubes with their names already on them. So it's another very convenient. The aliens happen to know exactly who they all are. And, you know, it's not really explained as to how that happens or how the aliens have insight into who these people are. But, you know, they know all of their names. They know their, I love how Spock just walked right up and nerve pinches. Boom. But, you know, what's funny about the nerve pinch, too, is that we don't know who it's going to work on and who it's not going to work on now, because we've seen a couple of aliens that it doesn't work on.
Yeah.
And it appears to work on the Vions, but it doesn't actually. See, he's kind of faking it there.
Mm-hmm.
So it's amazing. I mean, did he know about the nerve pinch? Did he know about that Vulcan ability and knew that he was going to play along with it if they tried it on him?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, otherwise, I mean, it feels like somebody just walked up and put their hand on your shoulder. You know, how would he know what to do?
Mm-hmm.
Unless he knew what that nerve pinch was supposed to do.
Right.
But interesting. But, you know, I was kind of questioning the empath herself, because, you know, the most famous empath in Trek is probably Counselor Troi, right?
Yes.
You know, but this empath seems to have, I guess there's different types of empaths or different races that can be or have those abilities, because Counselor Troi can't heal people, right?
No.
So I guess there are multiple planets and societies where or races where they can have different varieties of these powers.
Yeah, I guess it's like there's a spectrum.
Yeah, I guess so. I think Counselor Troi would have been much cooler if she couldn't talk and healed people. I'm sure I'll get some crap for that, but I had to do it. And there's our illusionary Scotty.
Yeah, and I love the fact that they tip off that it's not real based on Scotty's very sort of genuine reaction. It's very much a reaction that Scotty wouldn't have.
Yeah, you wouldn't see Scotty like, you know, big smile and waving like that. But here's actually another, that was another scene that had gotten changed because of the of budgetary problems. So in the original script, it was supposed to be Scotty, Chekhov, and Uhura waving from the illusionary landing party. But it to save money, they put two red shirt guys there. Randomly.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So that scene there actually raises another question for me. And you saw the guys, the Vions kind of put Kirk into a slow motion state, right? Where Kirk was kind of, you know, falling down and moving very, very slowly. And you always kind of wonder what, you know, one Trek villain versus another one would be like. So what do you think the Vions versus the Skullogians from Wink of an Eye would be like? Do you think they could slow him down?
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah, that's...
Because look how slow Shatner's moving. I mean, all they needed was one of those little hand machines, and they could have slowed him down, right?
Yes. That's like what? Like an Aliens versus Predator type scenario? I'm surprised the Star Trek comics haven't gotten into that, you know, Gorn versus Borg or anything.
Yeah. I mean, well, it's ripe for fan fiction. I know a lot of you guys out there write Trek fan fiction, so there's an idea for you. The Vions versus the Skullogians. So be an interesting write-up. Maybe a short story or something would be pretty cool. But now we know that it was fake. And yeah. Scotty wasn't really there. And I find it fascinating that the Vions know what Scotty looks like in the first place.
Oh, you know. Yeah, that's right.
No,
unless that was for our purpose and they were just sort of... Were they creating that illusion, or were they sort of planting a thought into their mind? But I guess that's not a power they have.
No,
it had to be a physical.
Yeah, it's not really explained, because you think are they like the Talosians in that way? I mean, it doesn't seem like they are, but they seem to be able to teleport you people around, and they seem to be able to make illusions, but it's not really clear.
Yeah.
How that gets done. It seems that they're very technology dependent.
Yes.
So I would think it's something that, like how the one guy has to point at the other, use your thing.
That was another one of those really sort of overt Kirk emotional moments where, you know, he was showing concern for his crew, but it seemed a little too amplified.
Mm.
And that's not a criticism. It's just a takeaway I had from this episode. And it definitely seems like it was a conscious choice.
I agree. And there are a couple of those moments scattered throughout the episode that I think Shatner seems to amp it up a bit. But yeah, not in a bad way, but it's heavier drama than you would think. I mean, he reacts differently to similar scenarios in different episodes. It seems sometimes you think he'll react strongly and he doesn't. And other times when you think he wouldn't react as strongly. This is a neat effect, by the way. Shatner stunt double hanging from those chains. At first glance, you would think it looks like he's actually hanging there. But, you know, when you really analyze it, you know, he's being held up by some other wires. But it does look pretty cool.
Yeah. And notice that Kirk is bare chested.
Yes.
And yes. Later... it seems like there was, I don't know, it seems like they decided who was going to be shirtless and who wasn't, because when McCoy's up there later, they keep his shirt on.
Yeah, and then when they transport Kirk back to the other chamber, his shirt is mysteriously back on. So who made that choice? Was it the Vions decided to take his shirt off?
Yeah.
They're like, you know, we really want to see what he looks like without a shirt on. Get a glance at the pit hair.
Yeah.
But his hair looks good.
Yes.
Nicely coiffed.
Yeah. So we're getting an idea now that we're getting more detail about the experiment that they're being a part of. And Kirk says, at least tell me what I'm dying for. And they have this great response, which is, if you live, you'll know the answer to that, which is such a... really a mind F of an answer.
Yeah, it's very, very ominous. And we find out later on that they know exactly what your chance of survival is. from these experiments that they're doing, whatever, that they haven't revealed the purpose of, but they know enough about what they're doing and your physiology to tell you what chance you have of physically surviving.
Right.
Or being not only physically surviving, but also being mentally damaged as well. So we'll find out that Spock would have no problem surviving physically, but his mind would be really messed up from the process.
Yeah.
But here's poor Jem. Wants to help, but she's scared. And, you know, for some reason, I every time I've seen this episode, I want to think that she has some sort of a ballet background.
Yeah, you know what? It's funny to think that, and I don't know. I don't remember completely offhand the Juan Ortiz card, but that's a vibe I've gotten too, and I don't know why that is.
I don't know if she does. I didn't read anything about that. I haven't. You know, I read about her background in television and acting, but I didn't see anything about ballet training, and I don't know if she's used that in any of her other roles before, but. The way that she moves when she walks like she's a dancer of some sort.
Yeah. Yeah, that was once when a couple of seconds earlier when she moved over to Kirk, it almost I had to do a double take and rewind it the first time I watched this for this recording. Because it looked like she glided over. It looked like she wasn't walking.
Yeah, she has a very graceful way of moving. And if you watch her feet, she actually does walk as if she's dancing. So, and this is a very interesting play between the two of them where Shatner is healing and he's doing some very nonverbal acting, some of that Shatner-esque nonverbal acting. And
yeah.
We have the wounds transferring. So you have more of that crossfade transference of the wounds from Shatner's wrists to her wrists and then her healing. You know, for the time period in the late 60s, I mean, we take these kind of effects for granted today because they can do all this stuff so easily. I mean, even amateur filmmakers with a computer can do this stuff at home now.
Yes.
I mean, you don't need an effects studio anymore. I mean, even using free or inexpensive software, you can with your cell phone, you can do these types of effects now. But back then, I mean, all of this stuff cost money and it had to be planned out, and it wasn't something that they could just snap their fingers and easily do.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when you watch a show like this, I try to keep in mind and not take those types of effects for granted.
Yeah.
So, interestingly enough, McCoy has some insight into how much of a tax it is on her body to heal you, and he's implying that if someone is injured enough, you know, or close to death enough, and she heals them fully, that she could wind up dying herself.
Mm-hmm.
So, when I was thinking about this, this reminded me of, I don't want to get too off topic here, but this reminded me of an X-Files episode that I had seen years and years ago, and it was similar, concept where I forget exactly what this human was, but it was some sort of an American Indian, an old American Indian who would consume someone. It was really creepy. It would consume someone who had some sort of an injury or a disease, and then that person would show back up a few days later, completely cured, and the Native American guy would take on whatever illness they had. So this poor guy was, you know, he had every illness you could possibly imagine, but he wouldn't die because I guess the people who lived in this town knew about this guy and they would use him to heal themselves. And
yeah,
that's where Mulder and Scully came in and did this whole investigation thing. But it was very creepy the way that they did it. But it's another take on a similar concept, and I'm sure some people out there who listen to the show would know what episode I'm talking about. I'm not a huge X-Files fan or an aficionado. I love the show, but I don't know each episode by heart. So,
same here.
Let us know which ones they are, and I would love to go back and watch that again. But so Spock here is going to figure out how to change this Vian device to work for them. So So once again, we see Spock using his superior intelligence to reverse engineer some alien technology that he hasn't even seen before.
Yeah.
So pretty impressive to be able to pick up something that was made by a completely unknown race and be able to look at it and say, you know what? I can tinker with this and change this and make it function in a different way. So that's kind of cool. And here they are saying that McCoy has an 87% chance of surviving. So they're going to make Kirk, once again, Kirk has to choose which of his friends will potentially die.
Yeah.
Yeah, they leave it up to Kirk. And Spock will have no problem surviving, but there's a 93% chance that he's going to be completely insane.
And, oof.
Yeah, so pretty rough decision. So McCoy dies, or Spock goes crazy, or there's a random chance, very slim, that they'll come out unscathed. So
this is really where the Blu-ray and the high def and the remastering really comes into play. An episode like this where the black is black, whereas in past iterations, you know, DVD was never really able to replicate blacks great. But here you're getting that true deep black, and it stands in contrast to the colors that are on screen. It's really, really cool to look at.
Absolutely. It brings out the color in their skin tones. It brings out the color in the uniforms. I mean, it's great that you can really hone in on that and watch it. I mean, we've said this before, too, and that these Blu-rays, you know, the color in these episodes is spectacular.
Yeah.
You know, look at how great. And you can even really see how great the pants were.
Yeah, it's really a testament to the work that they did back when they filmed the show. You know, it just shows the high level of detail that they were working with, and then also, you know, the care that was taken in filming it, and ultimately the care and love that was put into the restoring and the remastering.
Absolutely agree with you. And you know, watching these episodes as many times as I have since getting the Blu-ray re-releases, I've come to really expect them to look like this now. So if I see them from another source, like on YouTube or a clip online, and it doesn't look as good, it's kind of jarring to me.
Oh, sure. Yeah, that's completely understandable.
So McCoy has taken it upon himself to knock Kirk out to help him heal up, but at the same time, he's also kind of hung himself, because now Spock is in charge.
Yes.
And Spock, McCoy wanted to ensure that he was the one that Kirk chose, and I guess he figured by knocking Kirk out, he would more easily be able to convince Spock, since Spock is needed to rig up the that device, that he can't be the one that goes. But now Spock is realizes that he's in charge because the captain is asleep. So that answers a question too, by the way. We always wondered what happens when Kirk is sleeping.
Yeah.
So now we know that Spock is definitely in charge when Kirk's asleep. We knew he was in charge when Kirk was incapacitated.
Yeah.
Interesting moment between Jem and Spock there. She seems to be able to read his mind a little bit, if you will, and understand that there is some empathy and true caring underneath his exterior. I love Spock's reaction to McCoy injecting him with the hypo. He's very unethical.
Yes.
And Spock goes down. So I love how much sedative McCoy carries around with him.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, you never know.
Yeah, he's like, when are we going to need this? Ah, you know, I might as well bring a couple of hypos full of sleeping pills. So now McCoy has pretty much ensured that he is the one that they take, and they don't question it either.
No.
Like, well, it was Kirk's decision, but I guess since he's knocked out, I guess you have to come. So here's that moment you referenced where McCoy's shirt stays on.
Yeah, I wonder if there were some disappointed DeForest Kelly fans back when this first aired that thought they were finally going to get to see DeForest bare-chested, and they were denied.
Oh, that. Man. But see, McCoy's stunt double hangs differently. Subject McCoy. His stunt double hangs differently than Shatner's stunt double did. I wonder if they changed the way it was rigged up. Because he looks like he's actually hanging more from behind. Looks like he's hanging more normally, see?
Yeah, his arms are a little bit more up.
Yeah, where Shatner's were kind of out, like he was an Olympic ring athlete, where he was kind of hanging with his arms up. But so Kirk and Spock have come to, and I think Spock is making some comments about the device and how it's not mechanical. It's kind of attuned to brain patterns and brain energy.
Right.
So the technology is not what we are used to or what they're used to. But he's still able to readapt it to fit his own brain patterns, which is really, really kind of cool. It's something that is completely foreign.
Right.
But he's able to do that. So very cool. Did you know that John Meredith Lucas was supposed to direct this episode?
Really?
Yeah, and something else I gleaned from the book, by the way. And he was replaced by John Erman.
Hmm.
So it was another one of those trying to stay on schedule type things. And the studio wanted to stay away from the directors, even though he was contracted to direct this episode. They wanted to go with directors who would stay on schedule, but
so yeah,
we wound up going with John Erman,
which wasn't a terrible choice.
No.
Born in 1935, he had worked on a lot of shows around this time: Peyton Place, The Fugitive, The Outer Limits, Marcus Welby, M.D. And then after this, in the 70s, he would win a Directors Guild Award for outstanding directorial achievement in a dramatic series for the second part of Roots, and he also worked on Roots to Next Generation. So,
wow,
a lot of stuff in his filmography.
Yeah, and he was chosen for this partially because of his experience on The Outer Limits.
Yeah, I'd imagine so. When I saw The Outer Limits in his filmography, I said, "Oh, that's the connective tissue."
Yeah, he had done an episode called Nightmare, which was similar to this for The Outer Limits. So that was one of the reasons why. They went for him as a director, and this is pretty cool to see that kind of a connection there.
Yeah, and I'm always sort of interested in the one-time directors.
Yeah, as am I, and he's even said that he was not a big sci-fi fan. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this was one of those, it was a job that was offered, and, you know, you just took what came along at the time. So back then, you know, television directors, you get a phone call that says, you know, from your agent that says, you know, you're going to direct this episode, and then you're going to go to this show and direct an episode of this and that. So right. You just kind of did what you got called for. And it wasn't necessarily about what genres were in your wheelhouse, but it was about what work was available.
Sure. Yeah, yeah. And that really shows the sort of level of craft that a lot of these television directors had, where, you know, they weren't specializing. And I think that really sort of speaks volumes about the skill set that they had and their ability to adapt and adjust, and that even, you know, work with, you know, special effects. You know, whereas if you're not really, you know, if you're directing a show like Peyton Place, that might not be something you're focusing on as much.
Good point. Very good point. Yeah, you have to really be able to shift gears to be able to go through completely different genres from, you know, month to month.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for him to come in and do an episode of Star Trek and have to plan for those effect shots where he may not have been used to doing that. It's a very interesting observation. So McCoy
is in bad shape,
very bad shape. He's dying. And, you know, I love Kirk's reaction. Spock, he's like, you're not a doctor. You can't know that, when he tells Kirk that McCoy is dying. But, you know, it's a good thing that Shatner did get his shirt taken off, or his shirt would have been shredded like that too. So McCoy's uniform is going to need to get replaced after this, because it's got quite ripped up. Yeah, some great pain moments here by DeForest Kelly, by the way. He's kind of showing some of his nonverbal acting capabilities, and he's got some coughing going on and some writhing moments there, and very sad to see how Kirk and Spock react to watching McCoy essentially dying,
yes,
not being able to do anything about it.
Uh-huh.
So Spock's, the look of concern on Spock's face there is great. Interesting makeup work too.
Yeah, it's pretty detailed. They did a number on him, in you know, considering he was just hanging there.
So here's a little bit of an interview by McCoy, by DeForest Kelly. You know what, I'll jump to it. There's a bit from Catherine Hayes too that I want to quickly run through before we talk about DeForest Kelly's impressions, but she had a lot of fun doing this episode, and she really enjoyed working with DeForest Kelly, and she said you'd have to go a long way to find somebody nicer. Shatner Nimoy, very nice, and she couldn't have asked for better treatment. So as far as she's concerned, it was really one of the most pleasant things she's ever done.
Oh, wow, that's awesome.
Yeah, really nice. And DeForest Kelly said of this episode, I thought it was so dramatically done. The entire stage was blacked out in black curtains. Everything was done in pen spots, the lighting. And I thought it was so unique, the production values and cinematography. You'd look around and think, what a wild way to shoot a show.
Mm-hmm.
So some pretty cool insights there from DeForest Kelly.
Yeah, that's neat.
This as well. So pretty cool stuff. So now our friends are back, and their super force field is being used again to contain Kirk and Spock. And we're finally learning what the purpose of all of this was.
Yes. Which we alluded to at the beginning of the episode.
Yeah, we're almost at the end now.
So the sun going nova is playing into this.
Yeah. Yeah. A bit. So this is another case of an alien race attempting to, I guess, quote unquote, play God and decide which species or which society should survive this apocalypse. Because
right.
For some reason, they only have enough power to save one planet's worth of people. So we're not sure exactly why that is, but they can only save one planet, and I guess the Gem's planet is the one with the most potential, and they're testing her to find out if she and her people are, what's a good way to put it?
Worthy?
Morally worthy.
Yeah.
Morally worthy. So it's not about who has the best technology or who has the best superpowers. It's about who the Vions think is the best people.
Yeah.
From a moral standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
Which, I don't know. I don't know. This is a very weird way to go about this, because what they essentially have to do is they're using Kirk, Spock, and McCoy to teach her what they think is the best behavioral traits.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So she wasn't originally willing to lay down her life to save somebody else. But, I mean, even strangers, these are strangers. So, I mean, I guess it's a different thing from the Vion's perspective if you are willing to lay down your life to save a friend or a family member, but you to be savable by them, you have to be able to be willing to put your life on the line to save a perfect stranger.
Yeah.
So I'm not, I don't know.
It's you have reason for pause, Jeff.
Okay. I didn't, I wasn't sure if I was going too far out there, but I don't know. Is that heroic? I mean, do you really think that's heroic to, I mean, heroic's not the right word, because I guess putting your life on the line to save, other people is definitely heroic. But I mean, in this case, does she know that these guys are good people? I guess she can tell
mm-hmm.
that they're good people, but what if they were, you know, space marauders? What if what if these were the Mirror Enterprise guys?
Yeah. And at the same time, I mean, to show compassion do you really have to take it as far as they do? There are definitely other experiments here that could have shown the level of compassion that somebody has.
Oh, absolutely.
Without taking it to an extreme.
For sure. For sure. I mean, yeah, I think this is probably the most extreme you could take it to.
Mm-hmm.
And especially because they're purposefully killing or almost killing people in order to make her do these things.
Yes.
You know, and put her life on the line. And, you know, maybe it could have been done even in a quicker way of, you know, just having her step in front of a phaser or something.
Well, yeah. I mean, how would they have judged another race that might have been considered for this that didn't have the ability to do what Jem can do?
Yeah, they would have to make completely different set of experiments. You know, how would we do that? How would you test somebody in our world to see if they're that compassionate? I mean, you'd have to put them in some sort of crazy life or death scenario.
Yeah, which almost makes you wonder if this whole galactic survival contest was rigged for Jem's race.
Yeah, really. I was kind of sad that none of the other races that were in the running were present here.
Yeah.
You would think you'd have them off to the side at least, or you know, kind of like watching Survivor on TV. You'd have representation from everywhere and they'd all be pitted against each other. But the moral of the story is good, though.
Oh, it is.
You know, compassion and sacrificing yourself to help others. I mean, it's a good message, and it's nice to see that, you know, the human emotion wins the day again.
Uh-huh.
And even though you throw in this little bit of doubt near the end, and you kind of want to believe that maybe the Vions weren't so bad, but I don't know. I don't know if I can completely excuse the way they went about this.
Yeah, no, I agree.
So, I mean, they seem to be getting nicer as the episode wraps up. But I still think it was a bit of an extreme thing, especially the torture that they put McCoy and Kirk through. And right. The torture that you have to imagine they put those other two poor guys through, Ozama and Link, right?
Mm-hmm.
And who actually died because of it.
Oof.
And the funny thing is that they actually, Spock surmises here that they do have the power to heal as well as the power to hurt. And they do prove that out by healing McCoy, but they don't go back and bring the other two guys back to life.
Yeah.
That's kind of sad.
Yo, totally.
Those two dudes are just doing their job, you know?
Yeah.
I don't think they deserved it. I mean, they probably went to school for a lot of years to learn what they needed to learn. They were both doctors, you know, and their lives just kind of thrown away for no reason.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's kind of sad. And I love this scene between McCoy and Jem where he wants Kirk and Spock to pull her away and not let her heal him because she's going to die, and he winds up having to muster the strength himself to push her off.
Yeah.
Even though he's in a very weakened state. So very cool character moment here for McCoy in my mind.
Mm-hmm. So
at any rate, there was the push off scene. Oh, you almost got a little bit of a chest shot of DeForest Kelly there. The shirt's ripped almost to the chest. He's got his abdomen out.
So. Yes. So the DeForest Kelly fan club was able to get a little satisfaction.
Yeah, just a little bit. You'll have to wait for the calendar to come out. And another interesting statement by McCoy there during that scene is that he can't destroy life, which of course is part of you know, the doctor and the Hippocratic Oath. And oh, it was great. Spock didn't even attempt the nerve pinch a second time. He just walked over and grabbed the guy's arm. But so Spock figured out how to weaken and get out of the force field by completely closing off his emotions, which
right.
You would have thought he'd have done originally anyway. So the force field probably shouldn't have worked on him at all.
Yeah.
But great moment here by Kirk, too. He wants them to save McCoy, but they won't do it.
Yeah.
Because they say his life doesn't mean anything, and it's insignificant. But Kirk, I love what Kirk does here with these devices. I mean, he offers up all four of their lives. Like, you know what? Here. here's your proof.
Yeah.
Here's your proof that we're worthy. All of us are worthy of being saved. Here are your devices back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we know that those things are what gives you power over us, and we're just going to give them right back to you in defense of Jem, which is really cool. And he's calling him out on it, just like he called out Plato's stepchildren.
Yes.
Right. He called them out on their lack of compassion and how they've been stripped of all that. And it's pretty cool that he actually kind of gets through to them, too.
Agreed.
You know, the Vions are kind of like, you know what? This dude's right.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Very convincing. And Kirk often has a hard time convincing aliens that they're wrong.
Yes.
He pulled it off perfectly and changed their minds immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to bring McCoy back to life. So who's MVP in this episode? It's hard to say. Spock or Kirk?
Oof. I don't know. You could almost throw a vote in for McCoy as well.
That's true.
Because McCoy choosing to be selected left Kirk and Spock behind to become the MVP.
True. Yeah. Some good analysis. So
it's really a great showcase of the trio.
I love the camera when it flips back as the Vions are flying off into the blackness. I love that the camera pulling back on McCoy, Spock, and Kirk.
Yeah.
Who are now back on the ship.
Yep.
So for a bit of that comedy moment here at the end, where they're talking about human emotions saving the day, and how they're awed by Jem and all of that stuff, and they're going to give Spock the needles about human emotion saving the day and not logic, and Spock kind of blows them off. So another Trinity moment with Scotty looking on. So no Uhura, no Chekhov in this episode.
Yeah, although you can almost see some red there.
Yeah, if you look
behind Spock,
there was another scene earlier where you saw it was another girl.
Oh, okay.
Just some random girl there. I don't even see her face. You see her kind of from a back side back angle. So she had like short brown hair, I think.
Right. Okay.
So no Uhura, and no Chekhov. I mean, you got Sulu for a minute earlier. That was about it. Well, that about wraps up the episode.
Yeah, we made it through the empath.
Well, you know, Mark Cushman really makes an impassioned plea for this episode.
Yeah, I think when we talked to him a couple months back, he mentioned his feelings about this episode, and it definitely seemed like he appreciates it more than the average Trek fan.
We're gonna have to get him back on the show to talk about it in the near future as well. So I'd love to hear his perspective on it. And I say, after reading his piece on it in These Other Voyages, Volume 3, I have to say that I do have a different appreciation for this episode. Still not one of my favorites, but I was able to look at it through different lenses, if you will. So
yeah,
I don't think I'll be as harsh on this episode in the future as I have been in the past. So it might even move up a little bit over some of the other ones that I put on the bottom of my list.
Yeah, the one thing you can say about this episode is it's not boring.
No, it moves pretty well.
Yeah.
The acting is solid. The story has a good, definitely a good undertone, and it comes off well. You know, now that I understand more about, the black backgrounds and the stark sets, that it was done on purpose and not as a budgetary thing, that kind of changes the way I look at it as well. So,
right.
You know, I kind of like thinking about it as a Star Trek episode on stage, a stage play version of a Trek episode. But as far as essential nature is concerned, unfortunately, I will have to go non-essential on this one. So like I said, a couple of good character moments in there. The Vions are not a recurring alien race, to my knowledge. They may show up in other books and things that I haven't read, but I don't remember ever seeing them again. And it does give you an introduction to the empaths, which you will see later on. Other races, Counselor Troi, of course, the famous Beta Z empath in the next generation. So you do get the introduction to the empath capabilities, but they do seem to change later on. But I'm going to still have to go non-essential on this one, unfortunately, though. None of that stuff really puts it over the edge for me.
Yeah, I'm going to have to agree with you for all the points you made. And like I said, you know, this is another one of the many episodes in the series that it's a perfectly fine episode. It's easy to watch. It's got a certain level of performance, you know, that is really fun to watch, you know. You know, well written, well directed, well acted, but there's just nothing there to really put it over the top. And you know, that doesn't mean it's bad by any stretch, but it's just not essential when it comes to our ever changing sometimes criteria.
Yes. All right. Well, thank you all again for listening to the Tricorder Transmissions. As always, we're always happy that we have these listeners who interface with us on our Facebook page on a regular basis. Thank you guys so much. We really appreciate having you guys out there. And to anybody who doesn't interact with us on our social media but listens, thank you too. And you're always welcome to head on over to facebook.com/the Tricorder Transmissions or hit us on Twitter at TTT_pod. And we're always around. So we would love to hear from you, especially if we haven't heard from you yet. Please, you know, give us a heads up. Let us know what you think of the show.
Right on.
And all right. Any closing words from you, Craig?
No, just I guess to call back to our intro where we talked about all the interviews we've done recently. Again, if you have a tendency to skip our supplementals and just focus on the commentaries, please go back and listen to them because they're all great conversations and they won't take up too much of your time.
No, great. Excellent points. So we will see you all next week. Actually, keep your eyes out this coming Wednesday for the first installment of our joint episodes with the 5-Year Mission guys talking about their music. Great, great stuff. And we'll see you next Sunday for our regularly scheduled commentary.